From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. House Democrats caucus tomorrow over the party's leadership and potential new rules for moving legislation. It's expected to highlight factional differences between recently elected progressives and more moderate Democrats. Whichever way the conflict plays out, will a divided Congress be moving major legislation? We'll consider it right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Such pleasure to have you with us. Hope your day's off to a good start. Looks like it's going to be another nice day before some rain arrives. Coming up, with midterms in the rearview mirror, the 2020 presidential campaigns will soon be underway. Later this hour, we'll look at the potential Democratic field of challengers to President Trump, look at the positives and negatives of each of those candidates. But first, we're just over a month away from the start of the next session of Congress. Democrats have taken a commanding majority of the House. Republicans strengthened their majority in the Senate. With a split Congress, what's the potential for passing major legislation, particularly on health care? With us, Los Angeles Times congressional reporter Jennifer Habercorn, who joins us from D.C. Jennifer, good to have you with us again.
Thanks so much for having me.
So just kind of give us the temperature of what's expected. I know we've got the lame duck session for the next few weeks here. They're trying to do some things. How is the table being set up for January?
So Congress still has to fund a small portion of the government before they leave town. And there's usually in this lame duck session, the session that is between the election and when the new Congress is sworn in, you see the party that's leaving power, in this case the Republicans, trying to push through priorities, in that one last chance they have. And this year they're trying to push through funding for President Trump's border wall. As of right now, negotiations are ongoing, and it seems like, you know, he's going to get some funding, but negotiations, you know, could change significantly. And, everyone's looking toward January. We're going to have this new class coming in that's really kind of shaking up the city a bit. A lot of Democrats, a lot of young people, very diverse class. And focus is already turning to what House Democrats are going to try to do, specifically what kind of investigations they might do into the Trump administration.
Now, going back months ago, some Democrats had said that they were willing to look at funding for a border wall in exchange for some sort of long-term immigration reform deal. Is that alive in any way, shape, or form?
Just barely. That's always been kind of the hope of advocates of immigration reform and advocates of the border wall funding, frankly. This seemed like the outlines of a deal, but House Democrats feel emboldened. You know, they're going to take control of the House in December and can permanently block a border wall for the rest of Trump's administration. And so the thought is, you know, why would they give anything to Trump now? Of course, that could change if they get a good enough deal on immigration. But my sources say that those talks, you know, aren't really happening, and it seems pretty unlikely that that kind of a deal would come together.
What about criminal justice reform? That's something President Trump came out in favor of within the past week and a half or so. Any progress on that?
Yeah, that's a kind of interesting thing because it seems to have come out of nowhere. But President Trump endorsed a bipartisan bill to change some criminal justice policies and sentences, particularly for some drug offenses that a lot of folks on both sides feel are out of whack. And President Trump's endorsement will definitely ease the way, get this bill through the House. The question is the Senate, where Republicans are divided over whether this is a good idea. Mitch McConnell has kind of held his fire, has not, you know, said that he's going to push this aggressively. And in the next few days, I think we'll see, you know, does he come out firmly for it, firmly against it? That's a little to be determined as to whether that actually has a shot of getting through.
Los Angeles Times congressional reporter Jennifer Habercorn joining us from the Senate Press Gallery. We're talking about this very brief lame duck session of Congress before the new class arrives come January, right after the New Year's holiday. Tomorrow, there's Democratic caucus meeting, potential new rules for moving legislation, as I understand, on the agenda, Jennifer, as well as the leadership of the party. Flesh out a little bit for us, if you would, what's going to be debated tomorrow.
So tomorrow, House Democrats, the existing members and the new incoming class are going to meet behind closed doors to determine who they want to put forward for Speaker. Nancy Pelosi is expected to win that, as well as the leadership. So that's about 10 positions from Speaker on down who will control the shape of the party, the agenda that they push forward in the next 2 years. And Speaker Pelosi, or I should say, hopefully
presumptive speaker.
In her case, she hopes to be Speaker Pelosi, has faced some calls to step down from a small minority from her party, but they want new leadership. They argue that she's been there too long, and she's tried to tamp that down by saying that she's going to be a transitional leader. She's going to be a bridge to new leadership. So that's added a lot of import to these lower-level leadership elections because these are stepping stones for the day, you know, if and when Pelosi does decide to retire, who's going to take her place and who's going to take the place of her top two lieutenants who, would be viewed as part of the old guard as well. So Democrats will be voting on those positions as well as some rules changes. There's groups advocating that there should be more people at this leadership table to represent all parts of Democrats, you know, from different parts of the country, different parts of the caucus, from progressive to more moderate. And they want to see some changes.
And is there any potential for one of the rules changes that is going to be looked at, making it easier to move bills on a bipartisan basis through the House? Does that have a chance?
That's right. There's a group of moderates that's really pushing that. They want essentially a caucus rule saying that if they have enough votes, if they have 218 people who endorse a piece of legislation, that should be allowed to move forward. You know, one of the things that frustrates some members is that leadership really controls if a bill can come to the floor or not. You could have all the support in the world, but if the person at the top doesn't want that vote to come forward, he or she can block it. So one of the things they're proposing is that if it has the support, it should be given a chance to get a vote. So that could be kind of interesting if Democrats do approve that. You know, sometimes there's arguments that a bill may be a good idea for some folks politically, but not for others politically. So part of the speaker's decision is, you know, do I force some members to take what could be a really tough vote, or do I kind of prevent them, block that on their behalf? So that would be really interesting if they do make those changes.
Jennifer, thanks so much for joining us and talking about what's going on with the lame duck session, tomorrow's Democratic caucus, and what are some of the issues coming up with the fresh session of Congress in January. We appreciate it.
Great to talk with you.
Jennifer Habercorn, Los Angeles Times congressional reporter. Joining us to continue our conversation, Democratic strategist Matt Rodriguez and the dean of Pepperdine University School of Public Policy and senior fellow at Pepperdine's Davenport Institute, Pete Peterson. Gentlemen, it's good to have you with us again. I want to pick up with this proposed rule change that the incoming moderate Democrats are interested in. Incoming progressive Democrat from New York, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, is quoted or tweeted out, nine Dems are choosing to hold the entire 220-plus caucus hostage if we don't accept their GOP-friendly rules that will hamstring health care efforts from the get-go. People sent us here to get things done, not negotiate, she puts in quotes, with an administration that jails children and guts people's health care. Matt, I begin with your response to that tweet.
See, it's funny. It's actually a complete contradiction in there. Like, people had sent us here to get things done, and now she's saying we're not going to work with the entire other party. That's always been the – but this is what happens. Now the Democrats have power. They wanted power. They got power. The Republicans had problems for a long time trying to fight their Freedom Caucus, and they didn't want to pass anything. And so they didn't want to pass anything. So Boehner and it would bedevil Paul Ryan. It bedeviled the speakers to say, how can we move legislation? And now Democrats are going to have it's not exactly analogous dynamic, but it's not dissimilar. So you have the progressives who don't want to do any kind of compromise, because what some of the moderates in the party are trying to do is say, if you have some bipartisan legislation, I think it's like 20 co-sponsors on both sides, they want to be able to move that to the floor, because in the House it's a majoritarian rule body, and it's really the Speaker and the leadership that decides literally everything. It's different than the Senate. The senators are much more empowered. That isn't the case in the House. But what you end up as the progressives saying, well, that's just empowering Republicans. Why didn't, you know, they didn't give us that opportunity. We only want to pass the legislation that we want to pass. So you're already starting to see a little bit of the fissures that exist anytime that you have a larger majority. And now the Democrats do.
Well, I begin with your tweet because, as you say, it's inherently contradictory.
Yeah, it's an oxymoron.
So, I mean, this isn't just two factions. This is one person who expresses a contradictory perspective in one tweet.
Well, Ocasio-Cortez is a whole separate. She could almost do a program just on the Ocasio-Cortez. And in fairness to her, look, she's enjoying her moment, shall we say, and we're going to have to see how this plays out. She has become a kind of lightning rod on the right, and she's become a kind of hero to progressives on the left, but she's never really done anything in the sense of legislating or knows a lot about public policy. She's a very modern figure. She became a phenomenon. She's got a big Twitter following. She's all over Instagram, and she sort of says a lot of contradictory things because there's not a lot of, right now, at least intellectual consistency. Now, I'm not blaming her for that. She hasn't been in public policy for a long time. But people, the press goes to her because they know they get these types of responses. And that is, so she has become a kind of figure that everybody wants to jump on. If you're on the right, you're going to make fun of her. If you're on the left, you're going for, she's your inspiration. And the press likes her because she says these types of things.
Well, I just thought it sort of, it crystallized one challenge that's faced. Joaquin writes on the page, oh God, are we going to hear Ocasio-Cortez tweets every week? This is what Trump has wrought. No, Joaquin, I'm not. But it does.
Tweet of the week from Ocasio-Cortez.
No, but it does crystallize the challenge. If the idea is that there's a Democratic agenda to be moved through the House that might stand any chance of being passed, don't you have to work with Republicans?
Well, you do. Well, this is, and we've talked about this on the show, and it's not the sexiest thing in the world, but at the end of the day, our system moves through a sense of compromise, getting a half a loaf, not what you want. Politics over the last 20 years has become even more strident in saying it is a dirty word to give anything to the other side, because by definition, you're compromising on values. And so Ocasio-Cortez, she's one. There's many people like Ocasio-Cortez on both sides of the aisle, which is they sort of rise up, they become celebrities, they become well known, but they're not well known for their legislative abilities or their intellectual capabilities. They're known because of an appeal that they have. That's just the modern era. But the problem with that is our system is based on knowing how to work a system and pass things. But since that's a dirty word, you're getting more and more people who are like, I'm going to blow up the system. So in her case, it's like you can't work with Republicans because they're evil. Republicans' case, a lot with the Freedom Caucus, it was like, we're just not going to pass anything because, you know, government needs to be small and we want to get back to 1776. But the challenge is you have a lot of legislators who are winning these social media campaigns and becoming compelling, not through their abilities, but through just their force of personality. And that's a very modern dynamic. The problem is our system is based on being able to work together. And the more and more of these types of people who win and become compelling, the more of those types of people who run and say, well, we can't compromise our values, the less things get done and the more frustrated people are. And this is a bit of the kind of spider web that people are caught in and wrestling with, which is how do you get things done when your fundamental belief is we must get, you know, we cannot compromise.
So Pete Peterson, your thoughts on this? I mean, what avenues are open for House Democrats? For example, if they're going to try and move a so-called Medicare for All or single payer or even make a move in that direction, what's the potential there?
Well, again, I just completely agree with everything Matt said about the dynamic here. And maybe put another way, we're trying to force a parliamentary system into a two-party deliberative process. And a little bit more on that, that group of moderate Democrats, they were actually a part of, I think, one of the shining lights of Congress, which is this bipartisan problem solvers caucus that have been working to find a number of opportunities to work across the aisle for the last couple of years. And now they're actually putting their votes where their mouths are now that they are in the majority to say that we still need to find these opportunities to work across the aisle. But as Matt rightly pointed out, we're in a time and also in a system. We should also say that one of the reasons that we've seen a power swing to majority Democrats in the legislature is that it what we've seen is we've seen Democrats coming out and winning purple and even some red districts. We've certainly seen that in Orange County. So you're going to see more moderate Democrats. At the same time, you're seeing more progressive Democrats win the bluer districts. So it's actually become more polarized now on the Democratic side. And certainly you could argue the same thing on the Republican side. So it becomes increasingly difficult to find these opportunities to work across the aisle. And I think something like Medicare for All is one of those things that's coming from the more progressive wing of the party that's going to be very hard to find broad, or certainly bipartisan support.
You're describing, I guess we call it political physics, where when you get a single party, we see this in the California legislature, where factions have formed because it's seemingly impossible, even if one party controls a body, that it's going to agree on every issue. It must find ways of distinguishing itself.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And we're going to see that in the California state legislature as well. We're going to see more moderate Democrats that have won these districts in Southern California, in particular in these red and purple districts, moving into Sacramento at a time when there are is also an increasing progressive wing of the party as well. So what we're going to see in D.C., we'll probably see in Sacramento as well. The big difference being is that we have a Senate that's still on the in Republican hands in Washington, D.C., as well as a Republican president.
We'll continue our conversation with our political analyst, Pete Peterson of Pepperdine University. Matt Rodriguez, Rodriguez Strategies, his firm. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. And coming up in just a few minutes, we turn our attention to the very crowded field of potential Democratic presidential candidates. Back in 1 minute. We have some sad news to report. Creator of SpongeBob SquarePants, Steven Hillenburg, has died at the age of 57. Such a creative genius. We're actually out to dinner, saw him just a few weeks ago and briefly talked with him, and just very, very sad to hear of his passing at the age of 57. Steven Hillenburg of SpongeBob SquarePants. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We're talking politics with Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist, Pete Peterson, Pepperdine University's School of Public Policy, and we're talking about the upcoming legislative session. So, Matt, if so-called Medicare for All or single payer, whatever you want to call it, is DOA, because there's going to be no movement in the Senate with that. What are some opportunities for bipartisan bills?
Investigation of Trump. Oh, I'm sorry. Bipartisan. I'm sorry. I thought.
Yeah, I don't know that Republicans be on board.
I'm sure they're too
unless,
happy about
unless
that.
The Mueller report is so damning in what it comes back with, the Republicans may feel some
obligated
of them
to
have
do something. Well, that's a good point. So the Mueller thing hangs over this like a sort of a gargoyle sitting over Congress here, because we just don't know what he's going to come back with. There's a report out today that Manafort went and met with Julian Assange in Ecuador during the campaign. That would give some potential boost to was there collusion or coordination around Russia and what they were trying to do. And that's a whole separate rabbit hole. But the point is that's going to affect a lot of what people are able to do in Congress. I think there's some possibility. Well, the first thing is there's the budget, normal budget negotiation. So what you're probably going to see is threats of government shutdowns or, you know, funding bills, because that's what both sides are going to want to get something. Maybe it's some increased health care fixes. It's not going to be Medicare for All, but some increased health care fixes. Republicans will want to hold firm on the tax cuts. So you'll have negotiations naturally around that. And then, you know, there could be some, you know, infrastructure people have talked about for a long time. If there's ever going to be a big infrastructure package, like everyone talks infrastructure, then they come in and it never happens. And it always seems like such a no-brainer. We should do infrastructure, roads and bridges and give people jobs. And then it never seems to really come through. I do think that would be of some interest to somebody like Trump. He's probably shot as many bullets as he can around the tax cuts. That's probably given the economy a pretty big stimulus. There's a lot of reports saying that that's going to slow down in 2000. 2019. So he's going to want to inject something as he starts heading into his own presidential race, which we'll be talking about in a little bit. So something like infrastructure, where you can start sending different congressional districts and out into different states and say, we've appropriated X amount of dollars for fixing this and jobs. So I could see something around infrastructure, clearly budget. And I think there'll be some negotiation around health care, not because they agree on it, but because I think they're going to use the budget process to try to do something around those issues. But beyond that, I think there's going to be a lot of investigations and a lot of fights. And I think the Senate's going to be mostly focused on trying to get judges through here and try to hold on to the majority going into 2020.
Pete Peterson, what do you anticipate starting January?
Yeah, I think infrastructure is maybe one of the only opportunities out there for collaboration. But what that looks like exactly is up in the air. I think what was mentioned in your lead-in report by Jennifer about some of the issues here in the lame duck session could continue on. So I think in sentencing reform and some issues on criminal justice reform, you could see some opportunities for collaboration. I think on the farm bill as well, that's something that's definitely going to be examined during the lame duck session and some of these issues related to broader social programs. There could be some opportunities to collaborate. But I really do think that as we get past, as the new Congress comes into play, who the leadership is on both sides is going to play a significant role on what opportunities there will be for collaboration and deliberation, certainly on the House side over the next year and a half.
You mentioned the farm bill. Are you thinking potential changes in farm subsidies or food stamp rules,
yeah,
limitations?
More on the food stamp side, there's been some debate, and I think there's some opportunity for passing something out on work requirements for food stamps. That certainly seems to be a sticking point between the two sides, but I think there's an opportunity to come together on a final bill there. But again, Matt, I think the leadership question and the leadership on the Republican side too, whether it's Jim Jordan or somebody that's on the more maybe Paul Ryan or more moderate wing of the party, we'll know whether there will be some opportunities to work across the aisle.
Mm-hmm. Matt, do you think that there might be some Democratic votes on the farm bill changing the food stamp rules?
That's a challenging issue because it gets wrapped up because some progressives are uneasy with it because it feels regressive and it feels like you're targeting lower income folks, and especially on the social justice side. But then there are other progressives who feel like it's a big giveaway to big corporate ag interests. And so they're trying to go after whether it's subsidies or some of the food stamp issues. So it kind of varies. That's a sticky wicket. A lot of that stuff in the farm bill ends up really becoming becomes less partisan than it becomes partly ideological, but a lot state by state. It depends what is your state an ag state and what types of products are there. The sugar subsidies are a classic case of that, right? You have like several states want to get rid of the sugar subsidies because it really artificially inflates the numbers here and it costs a lot of money. But then you have states that produce beets. A lot of the southern states, the beet farmers are very, very powerful. So these things tend to get bogged down into sort of state by state politics, and it's less political than it is state by state ideological.
Well, and I was wondering if, when it comes to food stamps, because the expansion happened as it was a major part of the Obama administration.
Yes.
If there's a feeling of Democrats, we don't want to lose that. That was having so many more people covered by food stamps, fed by food stamps, was an achievement of the Obama administration.
Well, and I think the work requirements they will be very skittish about, simply because it's not just for the food stamps, but it's also that's going down the road on the Medicaid piece as well. And you've seen states looking to expand Medicaid. Republicans are often trying to push the work requirements around Medicaid. So I think Democrats are going to probably resist. And even I think a lot of moderates will resist a lot of that.
All right, gentlemen, I want to thank you for talking about the upcoming session of Congress with Democrats taking a solid majority of the House, Republicans bolstering their numbers in the Senate. They come back. They're in lame duck session now for the next few weeks. Then they come back January 3rd with a new session of Congress. My thanks to Pete Peterson, Pepperdine University Dean of the School of Public Policy, Senior Fellow at the Davenport Institute. Matt Rodriguez will continue with us in the next segment as well. You're listening to Air Talk. And our next topic of conversation is the very large potential Democratic presidential candidate field. Joining us is Alex Rorty, political correspondent who covers the Democratic field for McClatchy Newspapers. He's based in their D.C. bureau. Alex, good to have you with us.
Hey, thanks so much. Thank you so much for having me on.
I was putting together my own list of potential Democratic candidates, and it's 3 pages long, and I'm probably still missing people who would be considered on the list. But this is a huge field we're potentially looking at.
It's hard to think back to any of our previous presidential primaries, Republican or Democrats, where the number of candidates who could run is anything approaching this. You had a lot of candidates running, of course, in 2016 for the Republican nomination, like your Marco Rubio and Scott Walker, all these Republicans who had had, you know, some success during the Obama era, whether politically or in governing. But I just feel like that field doesn't even come close to matching what we think the number of people could be who could run for Democrats, and from all different parts of the Democratic Party and from all different parts of the country too.
Well, and the big challenge, except for a small number of these potential candidates, is name recognition. Even someone like Kamala Harris, our junior senator from California, who had a high profile during the Kavanaugh confirmation hearing, is hardly a household name across the United States. Similar with Cory Booker. Again, for people who follow politics, they're big names. But they're not household names. You know, they're just a handful when you're talking, you know, about a Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton or you know, people of that sort of profile here. Joe Biden. Once you get past those, there are a lot of people going to have to spend huge amounts of money to build name recognition. And so with that in mind, who appears poised to be able to raise that kind of money?
Well, it's a good question, and to your earlier point, I mean, it's not just the number of the sheer number of people we're running. It's that we don't have any clear front runners, right? That's how you normally structure the field. Now, the exception to that would be Joe Biden. And to your question, look, Joe Biden, if he decides to run, not only is he going to have the name recognition, but he's going to be able to raise money too, right? In terms of other candidates, though, who maybe need the money a little bit more, especially early, to try to build that name recognition. Look, it's a good question. Now, again, you know, I had referenced earlier, you know, you have so many different kinds of candidates running. One of them is Michael Bloomberg, reportedly now going to Iowa soon as he tests the waters for his own presidential campaign. He's someone who's not going to have to worry about raising the money because, of course, he is a billionaire, will be able to spend his own cash. You know, and I think if you go – so you kind of start with him, and if you go down the line, you know, Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, Cory Booker, all senators, and like you said, certainly don't have aren't household names by any stretch of the imagination, but are well known enough in the donor community, I think, that you can kind of reasonably expect that they'll be able to raise some money. I think where it gets interesting is some of these lesser known candidates who people think, based on what they've seen, who think maybe have the talent to make some noise. Someone like Mitch Landrieu, the former mayor of New Orleans, comes to mind, or Steve Bullock, who's the Democratic governor of Montana, was able to win a red state twice. You know, the question is, I think, are they going to be able to raise the money? And that's where it gets interesting, because those are the kind of candidates who, even if they have talent, if nobody knows who they are, of course, it's not going to mean a whole lot.
What about here in the West? I'm thinking of, you know, John Hickenlooper of Colorado. That, you know, moderate Democrat, is that someone who'd have access to money?
Quite possibly. And I just think, you know, one thing I think we have learned from recent presidential elections is it's less about your resume than it is about your performance. And what I mean by that is it's less about whether or not you were, you know, a successful two-term governor or a successful senator, then can you connect with the sort of average Democratic voter or the Democratic base during a debate performance or on the stump? And I think this is true just generally of our politics, that it is moving in that direction. It was certainly true to some extent, of course, with Barack Obama, who, of course, was just a one-term senator from Illinois, had been a state senator before that. he was able to win the nomination, and of course with Donald Trump, I don't think I need to explain why it applies to that situation, not someone, of course, with the resume of a classic presidential nominee. I will say one thing that I think you have to keep in mind with money raising and how it's going to be different this time around. Traditionally, what is fundraising, right? It's going to some fancy hotel and raising a bunch of money from rich donors at an event with champagne and cocktails and things like that. What we saw in 2018, and I think this is an important point, it's that online small-dollar grassroots fundraising. It's certainly not a new phenomenon in Democratic politics. It goes back to Howard Dean even in 2004. But that money that really powered the 2018 Democratic wave, at least in the House, I think is poised to play a huge role for presidential candidates, and that's how they're going to be able to raise. In fact, maybe even the majority of their cash comes from that, and that's really, again, about their performance, whether or not that's live streaming a stump speech in Iowa, for example, or during a debate night, having a moment that breaks through.
Online production values, all that. Right. Alex Rorty with us of McClatchy Papers. He's political correspondent covering the Democratic field, which, again, doesn't include declared candidates. But we're getting closer to that point with the presidential election now just a couple years away. We'll continue with Alex. Also, Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist, and Marge Halperin, Democratic strategist as well, who'll be joining us. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3, back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Herdes. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC, and I sure hope to see you this coming Sunday afternoon at the beautiful Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles. I'm very excited to show as part of our next Film Week screenings, The Artist, Oscar-winning film of 2011. A lot of fun, terrific picture. It's going to be a great time to come together Sunday afternoon, watch the film together in a historic L.A. venue, and then we'll talk about the movie afterwards. What happened during that transition period in the film industry from silent to talking era? We'll talk about some of the great locations around Los Angeles that have been recurrent presences in films over the years. It's going to be a lot of fun. Tickets available, kpcc.org/in-person. I look forward to seeing you this coming Sunday afternoon, 1 o'clock, Theater at Ace Hotel. Right now, our focus on the potential Democratic presidential candidate field, and I'd like to hear your analysis. Now, I'm not asking you to just call in and say, well, I like candidate X or Y. I'm asking you to analyze which candidate or candidates do you think would be the strongest running in the Democratic field and why? What are the reasons why you think they could connect with the largest number of Democratic voters in primaries? Who you think has the most access to resources to be able to build name recognition if they're not a Joe Biden, not a household name, not a Hillary Clinton? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. With me, Marge Halperin, Democratic political strategist, Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist, and Alex Rorty of the McClatchy Newspaper Group. Marge, let me bring you into our conversation here. Your thoughts about the potential for a woman winning the Democratic candidate. There are a number of strong potential women candidates, but with the exception of Hillary Clinton, all of them significant name recognition challenges.
Name recognition, and I've been listening to the conversation about that. It is certainly a factor, but I believe that it is not the same kind of factor that it has been traditionally. That is, Bernie Sanders didn't have a national name recognition really until he began campaigning for the presidency in earnest. There are a lot of ways to elevate awareness. And I think one of the factors that will help women in particular is the activated group that are out in the street who we saw help with the blue wave earlier this month. Here in Illinois, for example, I'm part of the organizing group of Indivisible Chicago, and there are Indivisible Swing Left and Move On and other kinds of groups around the country who formed a new campaign army that didn't exist before. We sent for the Illinois 6th District, in which we defeated Republican Peter Roskam, we sent in the final last weekend, 4 days, we sent out enough people to ring 20,000 doorbells. And really connected with voters, brought out voters. This is a layer of campaign activists who are set up with a network to communicate about exciting candidates and what they stand for, and to communicate concerns about candidates that aren't standing up for a progressive agenda. And I think this will help women in particular, because we see the strength and standing of women through both Me Too, the Women's March, and lots of activism from and, a constituency that thought they were about to see the first female president last time.
And you think that a progressive Democratic nominee can win a general election?
I do. And I think we saw that happen repeatedly in the midterms. And even where we fell short in places like Florida and Georgia, those are places you wouldn't even think you had a chance to compete. And in fact, in a lot of congressional races in the Midwest, in the South, Southwest, we won or we competed fairly and competitively in districts where we didn't even used to run a Democratic candidate because it was so hopeless. You wouldn't have thought, of course, no one thought Trump could win. He's governing from a minority, but he showed us how it could be done.
Matt, what do you think about a potential of a progressive nominee winning a general?
Some of it depends on who the progressive candidate is. So, you know, you had a lot of people last cycle saying, well, if Bernie had won, he actually would have won. This is what happens when somebody loses. It becomes a kind of open season
if the
hypotheticals all start. I'm a little dubious of that. The challenge, this goes back all the way to Adlai Stevenson in the 50s, right? I mean, progressives are always just like, if we just tell our story, if we just tell the truth, people are going to come our way. And every few years, people are like, it's going to happen. It was happening in the 60s while they were getting their clock cleaned by Richard Nixon. Then it was going to be the 80s and Ronald Reagan. I mean, the country is not that far left. And I think you saw some of those issues start to bubble up with Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders got away for a long time just giving a kind of generalized, here's all the things we can do. We can have free college. We can have free healthcare. We can do all of these things. And he was a press phenomenon, and it was a big story. And Hillary had been around for a long time. And so they were picking her apart one by one until the Clinton campaign really started to say, well, how are Sanders' policies really going to work? Like, how is this going to work? And when he really wasn't able to answer the, how are you going to pay for this? How are you going to pay for that? And then the story started coming out that healthcare would cost $32 trillion. This is how much college would cost. So I think it's going to depend on the type of progressive that's there. I do think that the battle around the presidential is going to be, you're starting to see these suburban women and suburban areas, the Dallases, Phoenix, like you saw it in Orange County, moving away from Republicans, partly because Trump is so polarizing. And so there's going to be a real battle for those voters, those types of voters who are not necessarily Democrat or Republican, but have moved a bit away because it's so culturally polarizing on the Republican side.
So
that's the fight.
For progressives, then the thought can be, if in 2020 you've got President Trump with his high unfavorable rating, that maybe this is the best possible chance for a progressive Democrat with a highly unpopular Republican president.
Well, and I was going to say, that is probably true. That is the one caveat to this, which is, I think if you look back historically, when Democrats go left, they get creamed. And then progressives say, well, we just weren't progressive enough. But that's really never been true. That said, Trump is a unique figure because he refuses in any way at all to try to expand his base from what it is. And that's served him well in 2016, but it served him well against a very unique candidate. But his refusal to abide by the laws of physics, while it won in 2016, you've been seeing the cracks. His approval rating never really gets above the low 40s. It's back down to 38, I think I saw in Gallup. They're tear gassing people at the border. He's going crazy in immigration. That makes a lot of voters uncomfortable. And so while he's done reasonably well still with white men, he's hemorrhaged a lot of other parts. And if they start hemorrhaging these suburban parts, not just the urban areas, but the suburban areas, that's going to put some states back on the map. And so I do agree this could be the one time where a progressive could have a chance. But remember, once it's one-on-one and you're going after that, that really will be a fundamentally different. So I'm a little leery of giving too much credence to it's going to be easy to beat Trump. He's still going to be a very challenging person to run against because he dominates the conversations to a degree that I don't care who comes out of Democratic primary, it's all going to be about Trump.
We're talking with Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist, Marge Halperin, also Democratic strategist, partner of Hawthorne Strategic Group or Strategy Group based in Chicago. So, Marge, let's take just a handful of candidates here. Who stands out to you, do you think, has the most potential to raise the money necessary to galvanize the party and to start winning primaries?
Well, I think there are a lot of options on the left and in the progressive community and in the Democratic field in general. And I'm hesitant to start singling out individuals. You know, we have the trio of women, Harris, Gillibrand, and Warren. You could add Amy Klobuchar to that probably from Minnesota. And this is a time period when we're going to look for their stand on issues as Congress hopefully becomes a little more aggressive against Trump and see where they stand on immigration is looming as such an important issue today and every day. And we're waiting to see where they come down exactly. I would hope that there would not be a purity test. I would not, for myself, being a progressive, I am not of the type who has a litmus test or a total standard. Everyone who runs for public office, everyone who holds public office has to make compromises. And in fact, we want them to in order to succeed, in order to move our government and our country forward. People will complain that Deval Patrick, for example, works for Bain Capital. I don't think that disqualifies him, but I'm looking for his policies and his stands on the issues that matter. So you could go through Cory Booker, others. There are so many out there now who have the potential to really lead our country in the right direction. I think it's exciting to watch the process play out.
We're talking with Marge Halperin, Democratic political strategist. We'll be back in 1 minute. We'll continue looking at the field and take your phone calls at 866-893-5722. We'll be back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle, we're looking at the field of Democratic candidates for 2020. Which ones appear potentially strongest? Who has access to fundraising or their own millions of dollars? How will they build name recognition? How will they deal with some of their negatives that would potentially be raised by opponents? Becky in Sherman Oaks, good to have you with us.
Hi. I wanted to point out that I think that the Democratic Party needs to be careful about who they nominate. I feel it needs to be someone who's more centrist, someone who's going to help unite both sides of the Democratic Party, as well as those who are the swing voters between, because first, of course, they have to get past the Democratic primary, but then they need to appeal to the Never Trumpers and the people who are dissatisfied with Trump.
All right, Becky, appreciate the call. Thank you so much. Let's talk with Claudia in South Pasadena. Claudia, do you have a candidate you think might be the strongest coming out of the gate?
I've liked Hickenlooper for a long time for several reasons. One is that he's a governor. We don't do too well with senators. And also, it's about geography. I look at the red center of this country, and I think, what happened to us? I think we need to get away from the coasts.
And all right.
He's a very cool head. Somebody needs to be able to handle Trump's playground name calling. I actually think they should adopt it and turn it around. Like Jackie Rosen, he called Wacky Jackie. Hey, Wacky Jackie's going to whack this election right out of the ballpark. You know, something like that. If we need a cool head that he can't rile up.
Claudia, I appreciate the call. Matt, your thoughts on Hickenlooper potentially being that person?
He's an interesting candidate. You know, if you look at where a lot of this is going to be a sequential process, which I think people tend to forget. Everyone sort of looks at who's going to they think of the person as the nominee and they think of that person on stage at the convention. But there's going to be a lot of hand to hand combat before that happens. So I think a guy like Hickenlooper, I think the challenge he's going to have is he's a relatively compelling guy, but there are going to be other people, I think, who are going to be more compelling, who are going to raise more money. What his case is going to be is exactly what Claudia said, which is executive experience.
I've been an effective governor.
I've been a very effective governor. Colorado, and you know, the country has done very well since the recession. And so a lot of these elected officials, this is going to be the challenge Deval Patrick's going to have. He was governor at a time when the recession was raging. It's the same problem Antonio Villaraigosa had here, which is things were bad. And it wasn't really their fault, but the metrics and the numbers didn't look good for them. But people who have been in office for a while now, it looks a little bit better. Jobs, their states are doing well. And Hickenlooper's case is going to be, look, I'm from a different part of the country. I'm from Colorado. It's a swing state, or can be a swing state. I can do well in Arizona. Maybe I can do well in the Mountain West. And you try to make a broader case. I think this a lot of this is going to come down to where progressives go, which is a sort of overall messaging piece, versus you're going to have, and this is inherent in the Biden kind of Hickenlooper, I can win some white working class voters. That's why we lost. We need someone once they get into the general. It's not just about big crowds. It's not about a big progressive agenda. That's
part of it. And suburban women.
Exactly. I've got to be able to appeal to a broader set of people. We just can't write off massive parts of the of America's demographics and just say that they're like not worth talking to. And I think there's a lot of Democrats who feel that that happened and has trended with the party over the last few years and got its sort of apotheosis in 2016. So I do think that's going to be a bit of a battle. Now, I'm not saying that's going to be the winning argument, but that's going to be a big case for people like Hickenlooper and Biden, which is I can go to Wisconsin, I can go to Pennsylvania, I can go to Michigan, I can win those states because some of those disaffected white voters will vote for me in a way that they weren't willing to pull the trigger for Hillary Clinton.
John, in Studio City, how would you handicap the field?
I would say I feel like a lot that I've been hearing, we've been forgetting about Bernie Sanders and how powerful of an opponent, candidate that he was last year. And in a sense, the election was stolen from him because the DNC was not willing to pull the trigger on him, no matter how large the crowds he had, which was and sometimes larger than Hillary. And he spoke so well that it resonated with the younger audience, the up and coming voters who wants to see change. And
I think that
talked about free college and all and it's really odd because for him to be such an older candidate, for him to resonate so well with so many people, I think he's the strongest candidate that they have. I mean, outside of him, I would say maybe Elizabeth Warren or Kamala Harris has really strong chances, which would be good for to have a women candidates. But I'm just wondering why we aren't speaking about
that. Yeah, I do think age is an issue. He's 77 now. If let's say he were to win the presidency, is to essentially be in his early 80s when he serves his term. I do think that would give a lot of people pause, rightly or wrongly. Mm-hmm. Also, there's the issue of his difficulty attracting African-American voters.
Yeah.
Marge, your thoughts on that?
I think that we have a different, somewhat different constituency. I'm not disagreeing that we need a white working class or working class vote entirely. We certainly do. But we have a more activated and expanded voter base now among people of color as a result of the midterms. There were some very strong registration drives around the country. And I think the electorate looks somewhat different than it did 2 years ago. And I'd also point out when we talk about the importance of winning these Midwest states that it comes down to, you. Well, I'll remember those three states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, two out of those three had their maps thrown out by the courts, and the third had it thrown out by the voters. Michigan passed a referendum to redraw their districts fairly. So I'm not buying into the idea that we failed to capture the electorate last time, any prominent constituency or important constituency. We know Hillary got the popular vote, and we know that she was up against illegal voting conditions in two out of those three states and improper conditions in the third. So I would caution against looking back too seriously, and let's look forward at the constituency we have now and consider women, voters of color, younger voters, as the caller just said, are now activated in a way that they weren't before.
Right.
And who are the candidates who will speak to them?
Alexander in West Hollywood says, any candidate who wants to unite the Democratic Party needs to be for Medicare for all. It's a deal breaker. The candidate has to endorse it. Sasha in Pacific Palisades that says Democrats need to have a clear message and stick with it. Don't say vote for me because Trump is bad. That's not a strong message. I want to know what the party stands for, something significant that would resonate. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. My thanks to Marge Halperin, Matt Rodriguez, and Alex Rorty. It's AirTalk on 89.3 KPCC. Much more to come in Hour 2. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Pleasure to have you with us. Later this hour, outgoing Los Angeles County Sheriff Jim McDonald will be with us. He'll talk about the handing off of the reins of the Sheriff's Department to Alex Villanueva. Villanueva is well ahead as the final votes are being counted. He came essentially from nowhere, a huge underdog, to first qualify for the runoff election when McDonald did not get more than half of the vote. It split among three candidates, and then Villanueva prevailing in the runoff election over the incumbent sheriff. So we'll talk about the future of the department, outgoing Sheriff Jim McDonald joining us later this hour. But first, we begin by looking at private firefighters. Maybe you've heard about some of the instances with the Woolsey fire where celebrities brought in their own people to firefight to attempt to protect their homes. That's raised some concerns about whether those so-called private firefighters are coordinating with the city and county firefighters who were on the scene, and also whether using private firefighters like that is in some way going to have a negative effect on the collective firefighting efforts done in the public sector. With us from BuzzFeed News, LA-based reporter Salvador Hernandez. Salvador, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
So in the story that you did for BuzzFeed, you had a chance to interview a number of different folks about this. First, how widespread is the practice of either insurance companies or individuals bringing in private firefighters?
So it's not very widespread, but it does seem to kind of show signs that it's starting to catch on. You know, private firefighters have kind of been around for decades, really, and their work was really initially actually contracting with government agencies, so with other fire departments. But so what we're starting to see in the last couple of years is that they're working with insurance companies and providing this service to, and usually it's actually insurance companies that provide very expensive elite services. So these are, you know, a lot more expensive. These tend to be more expensive homes. And what we're starting to see is that there are some more affordable insurance companies that are starting to offer the service as well by hiring these private companies. So what firefighters on the ground are saying is that they're starting to see them a little bit more on the ground, and that's kind of where their concern is starting to come out.
Now, does when we're talking about firefighting, does this mean that an insurance company or a homeowner might be able to have dispatched to an at-risk home, you know, a truck that comes complete with hoses that they can hook up to the fire hydrant and actually actively fight a fire? Or are we talking about, you know, spreading fire retardant, spraying that around, clearing out brush at the last minute? What are we talking about?
So most of these companies, the work that they do is preventative, right? So they do try to get head out, and what they're trying to do is harden the home. So it's usually the companies that are monitoring the risk, and they dispatch their units out to the home that's insured. Most of the work tends to be preventative, right? So they're clearing brush, they're hardening the home, they're putting the mats in, they're closing the windows. They're trying to lower any kind of risk of the house actually catching on fire. But some of these companies are actually very well equipped. They've got fire trucks that firefighters say look like their fire trucks. They've got water tenders. Some of them do have the capacity and the capability of hooking into fire hydrants to be able to get water and to spray water. So that's something that they're capable of doing as well. Although under the guidelines and from what at least one of the major companies told me is that they usually, or at least they're supposed to, request permission from the incident commander to be able to do that, because technically the fire hydrant, for example, is city property. But some of them are very well equipped, just like any public firefighting company.
What about the training? Are they, you know, firefighting is a very selective profession, difficult for people to get jobs as firefighters. So are these individuals who might have tried for jobs with public firefighting entities, weren't able to get hired to work for the private companies, people who used to work in the public sector? What do we know about the employees?
We're actually still trying to figure out a little bit about that. My understanding is that it, the guys that are working out there, the men and women that are working in there, that includes, you know, those who are kind of trying to get into the public sector. So they're trying to get a job at like a firefighting company. They just like firefighting, so they're joining it. You're also looking at retired firefighters. So usually you're getting people that are interested in the field as well. But what firefighters are concerned about is that there's really no guideline as to what their training has to be. So they're worried about the level of training because these guys go out on the field, and for them, they don't know what their level of training might be out on the ground. Some of the companies, like one of the bigger companies that I talked to, Wildfire Defense Systems, they're certified as a wildfire firefighters. And the company itself, they offer some training, I believe, like for an entry-level firefighter, it's like a five-day training. But what firefighters argue is that's usually centric to wildfire, wildland fire rescue. And obviously when you have like a brush fire, like Camp Woolsey, you know, it's a little bit of a different interface when you're facing mm-hmm. Wildland and a community, which can obviously affect the level of the fire behavior, and they're concerned of what level of training they might actually have on the ground or even experience.
We're talking with Salvador Hernandez, L.A.-based reporter for BuzzFeed News, who's written about the phenomenon of private firefighters. Also with us, the president of the company just mentioned by Salvador, Wildfire Defense Systems, which is based in Montana, but contracts with U.S. Forest Service and insurance companies across 20 states. David Torgerson, thank you for being with us.
Good morning, Larry.
So share with us the types of tasks that your private company conducts in areas where a fire's broken out.
Sure. I think Salvador did a good job of explaining that. Our mission is to increase the survivability of homes. And, you know, we follow the fire science that has come out. And one of the primary roles that we serve is to prepare the structures to be more survivable before the fire gets there. And a lot of that has to do with hardening the home so that embers don't end up igniting the home. And so, you know, we do things like removing fuels, taping vents so that embers don't get in the property, closing windows. But we can go so far as to setting up water tanks, sprinkler systems, apply vegetative retardant fire breaks, or even apply fire-blocking gel to the structures. Fire-blocking gel is basically sticky water. It goes on at about an eighth of an inch, and it's very effective in helping the structure from igniting.
Do you actively fight fire? If a fire's bearing down on a client's house, will you actually, you know, hook either use your water tanker or hook up to the hydrant and actively fight the fire?
Well, we're certainly qualified to do that. All of the personnel and engines that we operate are under contract to the United States Forest Service, and they're the same engines that our federal government and some state governments outside of California hire directly to respond and fight fire anywhere in the nation. So we can get dispatched under federal contracting and have since 2001. And so all our personnel have the same training and qualifications as federal wildland firefighting agencies under the National Wildfire Coordinating Group. So we're certainly qualified to do that, and we are hired to do that on a regular basis and have been, like many of the other contractors, for going on more than three decades back into the 80s.
Do you ever...
But that's not our mission when we're working with the insurance companies and insurer programs that we serve.
Do you ever get any sort of negative pushback from the city and county or state firefighters on the scene?
Yeah, so when we go in and do our mission, we're really just supplemental to the local, state, and federal responders. And so we're not on the same mission of firefighting. We're working to protect the home before and after the fire primarily, but certainly qualified to do firefighting, you know, because we're tasked by our government agencies to do that. We've been on over 550 wildfires since 2008, serving the insurance industry. 96% of the time, the incident management team and the incident commanders and civil authorities have seen the value of providing these qualified resources to be on this mission. So 96% of the time, we've been granted access inside the evacuation zones to operate, and we've had excellent coordination through the years, going on 11 years now, and like I say, over 550 fires. It was obviously newer back in 2008 and prior to 2010, but there's not very many incident management teams that we haven't interacted with across our service states, primarily in the West. You know, when you respond to 550 fires, you end up, you know, working with a good majority of the incident management teams that are out there. So we're a very known commodity on wildfire incidents, and we operate in very similar fashion as if, you know, coordinating, checking in with the incidents, just in the same way that we would if the government was dispatching those fires.
How quickly can you dispatch? I mean, you're covering 20 states. If you have an insurance company who says, we have a homeowner whose home is at risk in, you know, Ventura County, there's a wildfire that's bearing down, how quickly can you get there?
Sure. Well, we're centrally organized. We have a national dispatch center, which is, you know, very similar to how other wildfire agencies coordinate their dispatches. And we track wildfires, you know, 365 days a year out of our coordination center. And so we're dispatching to any of those insured addresses that fall in the programs that we serve. We don't wait for an insurance company to call us, so to speak. It's more streamlined than that, so to speak. But this is not a first responder service. And remember, this is just wildfire. So there's no structure fire component to this. There's no overlap of what, you know, our public firefighters are doing and you know, a fire department on a street corner. This is just wildfire. It's been well coordinated. And we're typically a second day responder. We can't access those threatened homes that we serve until there's an incident command post that we can check in with. And then once that can be established, which is typically the next morning after a fire starts, that they call it the second burn period. Mm-hmm. So we're typically able to be in the incident command post and waiting, coordinating with the liaison or the cooperating liaison interface that we have with the incident management team. So second day, second morning, and then thereafter, we typically or almost all the time get granted access, and then we can employ, you know, our engines, essentially our wildland engines and fire crews on that mission to, you know, increase the survivability. With these recent fires in California, we operated over 50 engines and served over 1,000 properties.
Where do you keep
not uncommon?
Where do you keep your engines? Do you have some here in Southern California?
You know, in the same way that our federal agencies move wildland engines and crews around with fire season, we do the same thing. So,
so they're coming from one incident to another.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, say it's in May, you know, fire season in May is typically in the southeast. Well, our engines will be, you know, mostly located down in those areas.
Right.
So we pre-position, you know, monthly, and we're responding to fires 12 months of the year now.
We're talking with the president of Wildfire Defense Systems, private firefighter, fire defense organization, David Torgerson, with us. They contract with the U.S. Forest Service and insurance companies and serve clients in 20 states. Also with us, Carol Wills, communications director for the California Professional Firefighters, the union that represents the public sector firefighters in California. Mr. Wills, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
What do you see as the role of these private firefighters, and does it provide a public benefit even though they're privately contracted?
To the extent that there is a benefit provided, it is it's our view that it's entirely in the preventive realm. That is, with respect to providing service as a consultant for homeowners on issues such as defensible space, making sure to help them harden their properties well ahead of of any fire. In some circumstances, prior to the development or the onset of a fire, if there's a weather condition that presents itself, perhaps to provide some retardant services. But once the fire starts, they are not considered emergency resources. These are non-emergency resources, and our view is that to the extent they're operating within the confines of the fire lines, they do not relieve burdens on public responders. They actually create an additional protection responsibility for the public fire responders, and our view is that has the potential, certainly, particularly if they are, as they have in the past, not operating in coordination or in communication consultation with the incident command. That puts not only the lives of those individuals at risk, but also puts the lives of the actual first responders at risk.
Carol Wills with us, California Professional Firefighters. We'll continue our conversation and also look at the history of private versus public firefighting here in the U.S. and elsewhere. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Back in just a minute. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. In case you missed the word last hour, Steven Hillenburg, the creator of SpongeBob SquarePants, the hugely popular animated series, passed away today at the age of 57 of Lou Gehrig's disease. A very big loss, and someone a big part of the local community here. In fact, our sons played together in a jazz combo last year. So very sad to hear Steven Hillenburg passing away at the age of 57. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We're talking about private firefighting and a number of companies that provide the service to insurance companies, sometimes even directly to homeowners, to come in and help protect their properties in the event of wildfires. We're talking with Carol Wills, California Firefighter, Professional Firefighters Organization. Let me go back to Salvador Hernandez of BuzzFeed News, who wrote an extensive piece about this. Salvador, do we have much information about these companies actively fighting fires behind the fire lines as a wildfire is bearing down?
Well, technically, under guidelines that were set under 2008 and actually a new bill that was passed this year and goes into effect in January, they're not supposed to. So they're not supposed to be behind evacuation lines, certainly not without first checking in with the incident commander. But what kind of drew this to the public spotlight this year during the Camp at Woolsey fire was that, you know, there was a report that Kim Kardashian and Kanye West hired, private firefighters to save their home out in Hidden Hills. My understanding on that, and from what I was told, was that that was actually after the evacuation orders were set, and the fire company that went out there, according to firefighters there, did not check in with incident command, did not check in with firefighters there. They went behind evacuation lines to do the work out there. And that was a private firefighting company. I haven't been able to figure out who that has been. But, you know, that's definitely one of the examples that, and one of the most high-profile examples that's out there of them actually going behind the lines and actually going against, guidelines that have been set for them. And firefighters say that actually has happened and they do run into them, but it's hard to quantify that when they're not checking in. So there's no way to actually know how many times it's happened.
Salvador, thanks so much. Really appreciate your being with us and talking about all the research you did and the folks you talked to about the private firefighting. Salvador Hernandez of BuzzFeed News. So Carol Wills, California Professional Firefighters. Briefly, this sounds like kind of situation you're expressing concern over.
Well, yeah, I mean, the bottom line concern is the concern that referenced earlier, which is that to the extent that these crews view themselves or are viewed as first responders or fire protection resources, they are a risk to firefighter safety. The bottom line is the private firefighters don't answer to the public or the incident command. They answer to their employers and to their customers. There are concerns about the training of these individuals. There are concerns about their willingness to operate within the confines of the incident command. It wasn't just this particular incident. There were significant problems last year with the Northern California fires reported by a number of agencies, where private fire operators were inside the evacuation lines without having checked in. The bottom line is they're not emergency response resources. They are non-emergency responders. Okay. They need to adhere to evacuation orders.
Okay, let me bring in our next guest, Bill Stewart of the Center for Fire Research and Outreach at UC Berkeley. He's a forestry specialist. Sir, thank you for joining us. How recent a phenomenon is private firefighting? Does it go back many years?
As I understand, I think as as David talked about, the U.S. Forest Service has been using contractors, for a number of decades as kind of supporting their, their very far-flung responsibilities that go everywhere from, Washington down to the southeast United States. So people have been doing it, and they've been, gearing up with the same gear that other wildland firefighters have, so having some of the same training. So that's been done in the wildland side. I think we're starting to see, especially in Southern California, a lot more people are realizing as we're having more and more fires that there just is, private owners want more resources to protect their homes, things they can't do themselves. And so you are seeing clearly the insurance companies, they get fire insurance, but they'd love to have fewer houses burned down so they don't put out as much money. So
we have Lisa, a listener, emailed us saying, my best friend and her neighbors had to hire a private fire service to defend their home on Point Doom in Malibu on the Saturday after the fire started because there was no fire department presence to protect their homes. Someone told me they had to sneak back to the properties to put out hotspots, and they believe they saved their homes because there wasn't a fire department presence to do so. So, Bill Stewart, those kinds of stories are, for those that can afford it, only going to fuel increasing interest in bringing in one's own firefighters.
Well, I think clearly as we go back to this, the issue is everyone's talked about is making sure all these resources are coordinated. We already have the challenge of having volunteer fire departments, local fire departments, county, state, and federal firefighters. But I think that's the key issue is having everything run through an incident command system so that all the firefighters, there's a clear chain of command, and everybody knows where everyone else is. And that's, I think, we're starting to see now the need for making sure that these new resources, if they become more and more common, are effectively integrated so that everybody knows where all the firefighting resources are and where all the firefighters are.
How did we end up with public firefighters? My understanding, for example, is, looking at England historically, that it used to be private companies that offered it. How did we end up with a model similar to what we have with police departments?
Well, in the West, we've had wildfires for forever. But we really came that why we have is that a public service was, a wildfire that burned the upper watersheds around Los Angeles or in the Sierra Nevada. They made, kill the timber, but they also generate all sorts of problems to downstream landowners. There's going to be landslides, debris flows, and things like that damages the people that live far away from the fire. So they realize, there isn't just the damage to the private landowners. There's also damage to the other citizens of the state. And so back in 1885, the reason the Board of Forestry was created was essentially to control wildfires on public and private land because it was impacting citizens of California that pretty much didn't live in the forest. They lived down in the agricultural areas. So it's that public damage that was coming from these large wildfires is why we started that and why it's continued to increase, especially as we're having more and more wildfires. We're just basically can't hire enough firefighters to keep up with the increasing, unfortunately, demand for them.
Let me go back to Carol Wills, the California Professional Firefighters, the union representing firefighters in the state. And the listener, Lisa, who emailed about her friends who brought in a private fire service to protect their home in Malibu. If there aren't enough public firefighters to go around when you've got multiple fronts to a wildfire, does it make sense for people to hire their own to come in and do this?
Well, I think we would argue, and not just labor, but certainly management in California would argue as well, that what that does, and particularly in these particular kind of cases, is create an additional protection risk for the fire, for the public public agency firefighters. Again, those private firefighters, they don't answer to the public. They're not responsible to the incident command. Ultimately, they're responsible to their employers and to their customers. And the decisions about where to operate should be made by the first responders, not by, you know, the private property owners. I'm very happy that her neighbor's property was saved, but the fact of the matter is that those people in that, who were behind the lines, as it were creating a greater safety risk for themselves and for the firefighters. Plus, these situations also can create something of a placebo effect for homeowners who feel as though, who perhaps have a false sense of security, and indeed the downstream risk is that it will actually encourage development in the wildland urban interface in California, which is the great risk that homeowners face. That's the major fire risk that we face in this state, unlike other states where it's largely more forest based. More people might be building their houses deeper and deeper into these fire prone areas at the very time when they need to be discouraged from doing so. So to the extent that it's prevention, to the extent that it is protecting, hardening properties well ahead of any fire, that's one thing that can actually be beneficial, because as you say, there are only so many fire prevention resources to go around. Once the fire starts and there are evacuations, these are not assets.
All right.
They are additional responsibilities.
Let me bring David Torgerson, who's the president of Wildfire Defense Systems private company, back into this. So you taking this anecdote about the couple that hired the private firefighters, they believe it saved their home in Malibu. And you've heard Carol Will's concerns about this. Your thoughts?
Yeah, sure. And I think we're all in pretty good alignment here, actually. You know, those of us who work in the industry and have worked in the industry for years, you know, understand the benefits of prevention and those kinds of things. I would say that private firefighters working privately for landowners who are not checking into incident command are creating a significant burden on the process. I have to completely agree with Carol there. It's a situation where we need our public firefighters to be able to concentrate on their primary missions, and one of the most important, if not the most important, is public safety. And we can't have anything come in and deter from that process, for sure. So having unregulated, uncoordinated, private resources running around incidences that aren't checking in is very problematic. But I think on the other hand, with the insurance programs that we've served for 11 years and with 550 fires of checking in and coordinating, we have 100% safety records. So there's a lot of concerns about what can happen during a fire, and it's a very challenging and hazardous environment. But the incident command system is a very effective coordination tool, as Bill indicated. And so
you've had no injuries?
No injuries on fires in 11 years and 550 fires. And so while the perception may be that this is something that can't be done, we've proven that it's already been done. It's just that we need to have regulation, we need to have coordination, and the incident command system provides us those opportunities. And you can never have enough resources during a wildfire. And if they're properly trained, state and federally certified, if they happen to be the same resources that the government's using already, you know, there's kind of...
Yeah, I need to break it off there, but I want to thank you, David Torgerson, president of Wildfire Defense Systems private company. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Now, coming up, we'll talk about the future of the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, as there'll be a brand new sheriff in the county. Yesterday, outgoing Sheriff Jim McDonnell conceded his loss in the election. We'll talk about that right after a live update from Hedy Lyn Herdes. Pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope your day's going great. Fresh Air with Terry Gross coming up in just a few minutes here on KPCC. But it's our pleasure to have with us the outgoing sheriff of Los Angeles County, Jim McDonnell, who's joined us regularly to talk about issues in law enforcement generally and his department particularly. Yesterday, he conceded his loss in the election to challenger Alex Villanueva. Sheriff McDonnell, good to have you with us again.
Morning, Larry. Thanks for having me.
First of all, I want to thank you for your willingness to come on during your time in office over your term and join us to talk about law enforcement. We appreciate that very much. And just want to talk, first of all, what do you see as your future role once you leave this office? Are you going to be commenting about the department and closely following your successor?
You know, I want to stay active. I feel like I've got a lot to offer. I've got almost four decades of experience, in particularly in the Los Angeles County area. And my hope is that I'll be able to find a way to be able to give back to the profession and the community, to be able to offer insights, to be able to, you know, be a great a supporter or a vocal critic, you know, as the appropriate occasion arises. But, you know, as we move forward, I just see where we are as a profession. I see where the L.A. County Sheriff's Department is as an organization. And in 4 years, we have come an awful long way. You know, I just mentioned downstairs that I believe in 4 years, we've been able to achieve the kind of change that takes generally 10 years to achieve. And with that comes some pain. Change is difficult, particularly in a bureaucracy, in a government bureaucracy more so. And we've been able to do an awful lot in a relatively compressed period of time. And I'm very proud of the work that the men and women of the organization and all of our partners have been able to accomplish.
Are you concerned under the next sheriff that the reforms that you say you're proud of implementing, that those might not continue?
I'm certainly concerned based on the campaign rhetoric that we heard for, you know, almost a year. Concerned about some of the issues that were raised, some of the support that he's gotten, particularly from the union and some of their desires to see things undone, the things that they fought me on. We stood tall because we believed what we were doing were the right things. We didn't do it for political reasons, and I wouldn't change that. And so I do have concern. My hope is that as the sheriff-elect gets exposed to the organization from a different lens than he's ever had before, and when he's responsible for the outcomes, for the risk management, for the lawsuits and civil actions against the department, for complying with the consent decree that's ongoing, and being judged based on what happened before. We tried to set the foundation for what can be done, what's possible in this organization. I believe we did that well. So I think that the milestones are in place. He will be judged against those. And I think that will temper what maybe he intended to do or what he promised to do in some cases.
Let me ask you something specific about this. In an interview with our Frank Stoltz, the sheriff-elect Alex Villanueva called a couple of positions that you created a dog and pony show. Those are positions to provide advice on being able to comply with constitutional demands on policing. So legal issues to provide consultation on use of force policy, on disciplinary actions. Mr. Villanueva says he's going to do away with those two positions. That's what he told Frank. Your response to that?
Yeah, I hope that he takes a deep breath, takes a step back, and gives it some time to be able to see the value to the organization and to him that team plays. We have two exceptionally smart, well-trained attorneys who dig into the meat and potatoes of the organization, that look at use of force issues, discipline issues, issues that are the ones that bring so much attention and usually negative attention to any department. And so to be able to have a barometer and to be able to do a quick analysis and see what are we seeing today? Are we trending in the wrong direction? What does our training do to be able to address that? All of the risk management efforts that can be put into place to be able to quickly fix a problem. If you don't have anybody looking at those issues, you're not even going to know there's a problem until it becomes a crisis or a scandal.
Mr. Villanueva, during the campaign, had been highly critical of the individuals who made up your command staff, and he had said he's going to do a house cleaning. Again, this was before he ended up winning the election. Your thoughts on that potential?
My hope would be that he would take a deep breath again on that and realize that running for sheriff is very different than being sheriff, and that while you may want to come in and move your people into your spots that as you see appropriate, we are running a $3 billion operation providing for public safety needs of over 10 million people in a very complex, dynamic, and sometimes dangerous environment. And so to take any of this in a cavalier manner is irresponsible. My hope is that he'll realize that the people who are in those positions are there for a reason. They have the background, training, and experience to do those jobs as well as they can be done. And I would hope that he would realize as well that these individuals are not just a position number on a sheet of paper. These are people. These are people who've dedicated 30, 40, 45 years of their life to the LA County Sheriff's Department, protecting the people of Los Angeles County. And in that time, they have developed a level of expertise that would be the envy of any organization in the country. And so while political talk is one thing, coming into the organization and being able to provide what the public expects is another thing. So my hope is that on so many different fronts, he will realize the campaign is behind him, and now it's time to do the job, and he's going to need help doing that. I hope he puts people in positions around him after he vets them very thoroughly, and that he holds them accountable and makes the message very clear as to what the expectations of the organization are and of each individual within the organization.
Sheriff McDonald, looking at your campaign and your loss in the election, there are three things that kind of stand out to me, and I'm interested in your thoughts. One of them, your opponent ran as a Democrat. This is a nonpartisan position, just like the Board of Supervisors, but he identified as a Democrat. You are a former Republican, no party preference registration currently, and didn't run as a partisan candidate. That's number one. Number two, the sheriff's, deputy sheriff's union endorsed his candidacy, which showed a lack of confidence in your leadership among that huge part of your employment group. And then thirdly, in a county which is heavily Latino, he is a Latino and was potentially able to connect with segments of the Latino electorate. Your thoughts on what you think led to your loss?
You know, I think all of those are very valid factors that played a role in the outcome of the election. As far as partisanship goes, you know, I grew up in Boston as an Irish kid. I was a Democrat. So I was a Democrat at one time, a Republican, like many, if not most, police officers are over the course of their career. And, you know, for the past, I'd say 15, probably years at least, I have been declined to state, which to me is the appropriate place to be for a police executive who provides for the safety of everybody in the jurisdiction. And so my goal has been to be a cop, not a politician, realizing I operate in a political environment, but not to be partisan one way or the other. My goal was to run down the middle of the road and as best I can provide for the needs of everybody. But was it a factor in this one? Absolutely it was, and apparently an effective one. As far as the union support, when people say you didn't have the rank and file, I would argue that until my last day. The men and women of this organization, by and large, are very happy with the direction we've been going. We came out of the worst scandal in the history of the organization a few short years ago. I came into office as a result of that, having sat on the Citizens Commission on Jail Violence, with a promise to reform the organization. I made a number of promises at my swearing-in speech. I would ask you, take a look at that. We've met every promise we made. I did what I said I would do in the 4 years. And so, again, a matter of pride in that. We have taken an organization that was on the rocks, righted the ship, and are going in the right direction and going at a pretty good clip as well. So the union leadership, the board, they made their decision, I would argue, based on the fact that they were not happy with a lot of the reforms that we were making. Change is difficult, and in this case, on some of these issues, very difficult for them.
All right.
Looking back on it, I wouldn't change anything. We did the right thing for the right reasons. And as far as the Latino factor weighing in on this, yeah, I'm sure it did. You know, for people who are in the sheriff's race, the amount of information that most people have about that is minimal. And so I think that people look down the line and you know, if they have a comfort level with a particular individual for whatever reason, you know, without information to support someone else, then they're going to go with that.
I want to thank you, Sheriff McDonald, again for joining us regularly on the program. And I hope whether it's you're serving as a chief of police of another law enforcement agency or some other position in law enforcement or retirement, whatever it is, I hope that we can call on you to speak on law enforcement issues in the future.
Anytime, Larry, I'd be honored. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Jim McDonald, outgoing Los Angeles County Sheriff, with us on Air Talk. Coming up, the aforementioned Frank Stoltz, who's been closely following this race issues in the LA County Sheriff's Department. We'll hear his thoughts about the changing of the guard in the sheriff's position, and we'll also talk with the president of the board of the aforementioned LA County Deputy Sheriff's Association, the union representing those rank and file deputies. Back in 1 minute on Air Talk. Well, I have to take back my promise. We were going to hear from Frank Stoltz. We're so short on time that we have a couple of important stakeholders with the Sheriff's Department that we want to bring on. But you get to hear Frank all the time, and we'll bring him back on Air Talk soon. Thanks for his willingness to join us. Ron Hernandez is the president of the board of the Association of L.A. County Deputy Sheriffs. That's the union representing the rank-and-file deputies, and they endorsed the sheriff-elect Alex Villanueva. Ron Hernandez, thank you for joining us. First of all, I'm sure you're very happy about the change. Your response to outgoing Sheriff McDonald, him saying that your endorsement was really about the pain inflicted by reforms that the sheriff was doing.
Thanks for having me. I think that's inaccurate. In fact, I would have liked to work closer with Sheriff McDonald, but it just didn't seem to come about. We suggested it on many occasions. In fact, before ALADS endorsed Jim McDonald in the last election, I was actually in an opportunity where, as a non-director and not even involved with ALADS other than as a unit rep, I offered as and my advice to him was, you know, when you get into the department, ask a lot of questions, but don't forget to ask the deputies their opinion and then work around that. And I never knew that I'd end up being the president of the union, and I did. And you would think the person who gave him that advice would be a person he would ask about different things. And we just couldn't, it was very rare that we could get in and speak to him. So we didn't really have as adversarial as he is putting it. Mainly, we just wanted to have some talks and talk about some of the stuff that needed to be changed. I mean, one of my biggest gripes is the fact that we're short approximately 1,500 deputies, and yet we helped force into a task force to try and figure out what the problems were. And we were on that task force for about a year, and I saw absolutely no changes. We haven't really gained any bodies, and that leads to low morale.
So there were recommendations coming out of that task force?
Correct. We spoke to, very simple. You know, we talked about we don't have the facilities to put more classes through. And I asked a simple question like Star Center, which we still are in there. We have offices in there, which used to be the academy over in Whittier. I asked, well, if we don't have enough facilities, how come we don't reopen that? And literally, I brought this up to one of the assistant sheriffs, and they looked at me dumbfounded, like they never even thought of opening another facility. So that's a very important, that relates to low morale because deputies are overworked. And then that should be concerning to the public, because if deputies are overworked and tired and frustrated, then they end up answering the radio calls as opposed to what we are used to doing is being proactive in the communities and going out there and being aware of what's going around so that people don't sit back and just wait for people to call us. All right. We want to be out there. But when you're short-staffed, it's very hard to do that.
Ron Hernandez, thank you. I'm sorry we have such little time, but I hope you'll come back soon and we can talk more about some of these concerns of the deputies and what you want to see under the new sheriff. Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Ron Hernandez is the president of the board of the Association of L.A. County Deputy Sheriffs, or ELADS. Also with us, the member of the Citizens Commission on Jail Violence, which was established quite a few years ago to examine deputy use of force in the jails, is a former U.S. District Judge, Robert Bonner. Sir, thank you for being with us.
Happy to be with you, Larry.
What are your concerns about the change in leadership of the department?
Well, obviously, the concern is that there be a smooth transition. Certainly, as I don't speak for the Civilian Oversight Commission for the Sheriff's Department, but as a member of the Oversight Commission, we certainly look forward to working closely and cooperatively with the new sheriff in town or the new sheriff in the county, Sheriff Villanueva. There are no shortage of challenges for the new sheriff. And I say that with the understanding that I think Sheriff McDonald did an excellent job, but he's acknowledged himself, he's probably not the greatest politician in the world. And I don't mean that critically. I've never run for elective office myself. But there are no shortage of challenges. One was just mentioned by Mr. Hernandez for the union, and that is that there is the Sheriff's Department is understaffed. It has recruiting and hiring issues that need to be addressed. These may involve structural issues for the department. But beyond that, there are things that the Oversight Commission has been looking into that are serious issues and challenges. One is eliminating the secretive cliques and subcultures that exist, at least in some of the Sheriff's Department stations. It's reducing excessive and unnecessary use of force. It's implementing body-worn cameras, fully implementing the Prison Rape Elimination Act, and the like. So there are plenty of issues for the new sheriff to tackle and deal with, and hopefully he will. And certainly the Civilian Oversight Commission is there to hopefully to cooperate and assist him in making the needed reforms to the Sheriff's Department.
Do you have concerns about Mr. Villanueva telling our reporter that he's going to do away with the two legal advisors on constitutional policing?
Yes, I would be. I have concerns about that. I mean, certainly the best practice of law enforcement organizations is to have, it doesn't have to be two, but to have somebody on the staff that's advising with respect to a constitutional policy with respect to use of force, particularly in an era where the spotlight is on law enforcement organizations regarding unlawful and excessive use, particularly of lethal force. So I think it makes sense to have somebody on your staff who is looking at and addressing that issue, and somebody who can do that knowledgeably, and that is to know what the legal requirements are.
Mr. Bonner, thank you. We appreciate your talking with us today.
You bet. Take care, Larry.
Thank you, Robert Bonner, member of the Citizens Commission on Jail Violence. Police in Maryland are investigating a possible report of an active shooter at the Walter Reed Hospital outside Washington. Police called to the scene there about half an hour ago. In a tweet, U.S. Member of Congress Dutch Ruppersberger of Maryland says he and about 40 people in a conference room at the hospital. More details to come.